Well, let me give you the official introduction here. So welcome to Harvard Geography Colloquium. This is the October edition. We're actually going to have two talks in October. And we're delighted to have Anne Kelly Knowles with us today. She did her PhD from University of Madison, Wisconsin, and since then has taught and done research at University of Wales, done many different kinds of research, specializing in geovisualization, among many other things, focused on the Holocaust for a lot of years. And we're very happy to have her today. So with that, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Jeff. I told Wendy this morning that I feel I've come here today seeking help. The Holocaust Geographies Project, which I've been a part of now for, we're entering our ninth year actually, is an interdisciplinary group of historians and geographers from a number of institutions in the US, New Zealand, and the UK, who have been developing new geographically based approaches to studying the Holocaust. We started with asking just, is GIS a potentially useful methodology for studying the Holocaust? And I'll show you a little bit of the work that we did to try to answer that question. The answer to us seemed to be a resounding yes. It is incredibly useful, has enormous potential. The project continues to develop with new members coming in. We're now getting connected with some computer scientists who are helping us learn some basic corpus linguistics, among other things. And so it's very much in progress. The reason I need help today will become clear in the course of the talk. We are facing a number of new challenges of dealing with very complex data, which we hope to derive from Holocaust testimony, which is very, very difficult material to work with. So that's my introduction. So let me launch right in. I have a couple of parts to my presentation. First, I'd like to give a quick overview of spatial research as it has been done in Holocaust studies. Then I'll go to our big research question right now. How can we bring victims into the spaces and places of the Holocaust? So a bit of background. Mapping has always been a part of Holocaust research and documentation. My first example here is one of the maps created by UNRWA, or some people say UNRWA, the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, which was set up almost immediately after the war to try to collect any information possible to help survivors and displaced persons of the war and what was not yet called the Holocaust, find their families, find their way back home, but especially to find their family members. One of the events of the Holocaust, which they documented among many others, were the evacuation marches, which were done out of concentration and labor camps, forced marches, often in great haste. They are sometimes also called death marches, rarely done in order to kill people, but because of the conditions and people emaciated, people who had gone through dreadful experiences marching in the winter of 1945, many, many people died. So this is one of the many maps. This is, I think, a print from microfilm of the original document. And one of my students some years ago, it's the beginning of georeferencing here, then traced that line and began to ask questions like, how good is this information? How certain are we of those places? Whose information, whose testimony, or whose interview, or what newspaper reports are the basis of this information? Often very difficult to reconstruct. So one thing this map always reminds me of is the uncertainty of information derived from the end of the war, but throughout the Holocaust, really. Another thing this map tells me is that I'm really bothered by the geometry of much Holocaust mapping. Connect the dots, well, yeah, that suggests a route, but who knows if they actually followed those routes. This map also does not include time, which is very, very important to the story. How long did it take to walk? Were they walking or on a train? And so on and so forth. Here's a map that has a little more dynamic quality, and this takes me to the second kind of mapping that's been done after Raoul Hilberg really sort of invented the field of Holocaust studies with his book, The Destruction of the European Jews, published in 1961, and more scholars gradually became interested in this subject. Atlases began to appear. This is from, I think, the first edition of British historian Martin Gilbert's Atlas of the Holocaust, which remains in print. I don't know what edition he's in now. It's a standard textbook for Holocaust courses. So this uses arrows to track three evacuations in April, so very late. The evacuation phenomenon went on for some time. And this map omits some things that the other map tried to include, which I think are also important to the story and often left out, especially in maps by historians, which is topography, as well as weather, the physical conditions, which were played such a huge role in victims' experiences during the Holocaust. Another example of a Holocaust atlas from a major institution, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. There are a number of Holocaust atlases in some various languages, and this is fairly typical of institutional atlases that I've found. It is educational, it is summary, it includes, in this case, major deportations. Fair enough, they're telling us what we're seeing, but it is so generalized that beyond its pedagogical value, one can't derive much from a map like this. And another thing that this reminds me of, many of the atlases I've seen when they show just the major camps. And as I'll show you in a moment, there were many, many more camps than those, the famous ones. So let me move in a slightly different direction now. Background of spatial ideas related to the Holocaust. Geographers, especially for many decades now, I would say since the 1960s in particular, have been aware of the influence of geographers on the development of Nazi spatial theory, Hitler's ideas and the spatial ideologies of the Nationalist Socialist movement as a whole. This is Friedrich Ratzel, one of the German geographers from the mid-late 19th century, who developed ideas that the Nazis found very useful. Ratzel's most famous term in that context is Lebensraum, the idea that every people, every race, has its native realm, its habitat, to which it has adapted over time. And he did not go as far as to say that, therefore, that people has an exclusive right to that territory, but that was the direction that Hitler and his Nazi ideologues took. The concept of Blut und Boden is another related concept, which is inherently spatial. The racial purification of the Reich is those ideas put into action. The Reich's Office for Spatial Planning, for example, and the Reich Association for Area Research employed many geographers and tried to implement geographical ideas. One of the young geographers who was at the right place in the right time as the Nationalist Socialists were organizing themselves was Walter Kristaller, who became famous, I think, because of the timing. He published a dissertation in 1933 on what he called central place theory, which was a pretty radical abstraction of the urban hierarchy with various interesting ideas attached to it. One of the core ideas was, as you go up the urban hierarchy, goods and services become more and more specialized. So you go to Boston for surgery, you probably don't go to Orono, Maine for surgery. And as you go down the hierarchy, local places provide for everyday needs. Newspapers, etc. It's a very sort of intuitive theory. But in the hands of Nazi planners, these ideas became instrumentally useful for mapping, for designing and planning the new Reich in the East. So the Generalplan Ost, the big plan for developing Eastern Europe once the German army would conquer that territory, was based in part on these sorts of ideas of building a rational system of cities and eradicating some if they were in the wrong place or weren't in the sort of right order of the hierarchies. This is very idealistic, and almost none of it was implemented, but it was in people's minds. What was definitely implemented were ideas, including some fairly idealistic ones, for planning building sites, particular places. This is an historical photograph of SS architects at work. I think this is leaning on my colleague and collaborator, Paul Jaskot, who's an architectural historian at DePaul University in Chicago. He thinks this is a photograph from Berlin. It's from the Bundesarchiv. He thinks it shows architects working for the Zentralbauleitung on possibly plans of Auschwitz. And here is a plan of Auschwitz generated by such a person. His name was Lothar Hartenstein. This is his 1942 plan for Auschwitz. It reminds us that part of the for Auschwitz among SS planners was that it would become a new capital for the extended Reich. And it would have many lovely features. I'll just draw your eye to the lower right-hand part of this plan where there are streets and buildings on a sort of gentle curve. That was to be a little sort of garden city development for SS officers that would have handsome row houses with gardens and the sort of gracious urban plan that was very popular in the early 20th century in Germany and elsewhere. So the implementation of ideology in architecture is also something that scholars, including geographers and many others, have been studying in the last several decades. There's, I think, renewed interest in these ideas as theoretical ideas develop as well. And here I'll turn to what is going on right now. There's a very strong theoretical turn in Holocaust studies coming from geographers and historians interested in spatial concepts, particularly inspired by the work of an Italian social critic and philosopher named Agamben. And his ideas, as well as Guattari and Deleuze, they're sort of part of the mix. The idea that Nazi ideology was biopolitics writ large, even the arch example of biopolitics, that is that people are understood by who they are biologically, and that racial distinctions are a basis for politics throughout the structure of a nation. And there are two geographers working in Italy today, Claudio Minca and Paolo Giacaria, who are particularly focusing on developing Agamben's theories. Agamben also wrote a very influential essay on Auschwitz as the threshold of modernity. They're trying to develop these ideas for a whole new understanding of the Third Reich. And here I quote from them a little bit, that the struggle for space at the core of the Nazis' geographic imagination reached its peak with the war between two antithetical races, the Germans and the Jews. In other words, the Holocaust was part of the spatial revolution of Nazism, the spatial cleansing of vast regions, urban planning on a grand scale, the conquering and remaking of much of a continent. The other branch of recent scholarship I would call an empirical turn in Holocaust studies. Holocaust studies, until maybe a decade ago, was overwhelmingly research in the humanities by literary scholars, scholars of religion, historians, of course. Very little social science work, very little mapping, and no GIS at all, as far as I know, except perhaps for making a few very simple maps. The empirical turn in Holocaust studies is being led by efforts to document places. What I've described up till now, I think more has to do with documenting space and movement during the Holocaust, Documenting places requires other strategies. And here I have different kinds of examples and different kinds of atlases. This is one representative two-page spread from a remarkable book called The Lithuanian Holocaust Atlas by the lead editor and photographer and field researcher is Milda Jakulce Vasil. I met her in Germany a couple of years ago, and she almost single-handedly researched several hundred sites of mostly mass murder in Lithuania, some of which had memorials, many of which did not. She began the project because she felt that there was far too much denial of Lithuanian involvement in the Holocaust, and she thought the best way to try to make her case was geographically, visually, and that by documenting places that could help people admit what had happened and enhance and increase memorialization. This atlas was published in 2011. If you're interested, I'd be happy to connect you with her. There also is an online version of this, the Lithuanian Holocaust Atlas. More and more of this material is available in a very handsome interface. Another project aimed at refuting denial of involvement is based in Italy, but is covering much of southeastern Europe. It's led by a group called AudioDoc, D-O-C, and the leader of that effort, this is the Fields of Fascism project, Fascisti, I forget what Fields is, anyone know in Italian? Anyway, you can't download anything from their website, but the website, they're posting all of their work on the website, and it's kind of similar, not as elegant as the Lithuanian project, but they're trying to document 10 different kinds of sites of imprisonment, forced labor, detention, punishment, murder, and so forth, again, to refute claims of nations and communities not being involved in the Holocaust. And they have over 600 sites documented in Italy alone, where the previous count was below 100. So this is fundamental sort of forensic historical work. Project that may be better known because a book has been published out of the work that's certainly widely used in classes is Father Patrick Dubois's forensic efforts to document mass murder in Ukraine, mass murder of Jews. He thinks as many as 1.5 million Jews were slaughtered in Ukraine, and his book is The Holocaust by Bullets, published by Palgrave in English in 2008. The other empirical effort is a major empirical effort that is involving more than one or two scholars at a time is the project I'm involved in. The Holocaust Historical GIS is how we started. We're now the Holocaust Historical, the Holocaust Geographies Collaborative. This is a title, a cover shot from our book, which was published in 2014. And our collaborative, which involves, if you don't count all the students involved, it's about a dozen people, has been trying to document case studies of many different qualities and events of the Holocaust. My first example is from the Budapest ghetto. Unlike many of the better known ghettos, in Budapest, the ghetto was distributed throughout the center of the city and even out into the suburbs. We think of often a Holocaust ghetto as a walled place within a city like Warsaw, the most famous example, or Łódź. But in Budapest, Jewish residences were designated as apartments or buildings or part of a street. And so it's a much more distributed kind of restriction of people's residence, and then they were restricted in movement as well. This first map is the city street plan as of approximately 1944. With all the little dots, which you can just pick out as Jewish designated residences in as of June 44. And the flow lines come out of an estimate of its least cost analysis. How could people walk most quickly to a market hall from where they live? So the thicker the line, the program is telling you the more likely there are more and more people traveling down a certain street. The little sort of kiosk black shapes are the market halls. So The story is people would need to go out almost every day for food, and the people who live closest to the market halls would have the most access. But the other thing that this shows us or suggests is that bypassers, people in shops and apartment buildings, would have seen many, many Jews on the street during the 3 hours of a day at this certain time of year when they were allowed out of their residences. Then I have a series of three maps out of this project where the pale yellow center color is the GIS estimate of people being able to walk from their residence to a market hall in 30 minutes or less. Then the tan color is up to 60 minutes to get from a residence to the nearest market hall. And beyond the tan, it would take more than an hour. If you're allowed out of your residence for only 3 hours a day, you can quickly imagine people facing difficulties. So this is access to food, an estimate, a simulation. This is access to one of the two Swedish legations, where Jews were anxious to go, and the lines, there are photographs of the lines outside these buildings of people waiting and waiting and waiting to get inside in hopes of getting papers to escape Hungary. And then this is access to a hospital. And this was not just being able to visit loved ones, but being able to bring food to them and all sorts of other needs. So I find this project probably comes the closest out of our work to helping one at least imagine victims' experiences and circumstances, their spatial circumstances, during the restrictions of the Holocaust in Hungary. Then I'm going to go back to Hartenstein's plan just for a moment, again, draw your eye to that curving shape, and show you an example from another one of our projects, Auschwitz, which Paul Jaskott and I worked on with a team at Middlebury College. And here is the plan, and here is our GIS-based rendering using colors to indicate which buildings in this part of Auschwitz I were planned but never built. Those are orange, including that Garden City development, that neighborhood. In green, they were planned by architects and built as planned, and in purple, Paul found no evidence of buildings being planned by an SS architect, but there is evidence that the buildings were constructed. So the purple set of four rectangles, kind of in the dead center of this graphic, stacked one after the other, are barracks built for guards to handle the shipment of Hungarian Jews in 1944. They were anticipating several hundred thousand and needed a much enlarged guard force to control those arrivals. So this became the beginning of another idea out of this project that we could use GIS to compare Nazi plans against what happened on the ground, which to me as an historical geographer is ultimately what I'm most interested in. Nazi ideology is incredibly interesting, but I really want to know what happened to people. And what they chose to do and not do. And this is my last rendering out of, this is actually out of CAD, computer-assisted design, which architects use. One of the folks on our Auschwitz project took building plans from the Berlin archives, from the Zentralbauleitung, and reconstructed a digital Birkenau, which we then used subsequently to show the construction of the camp over time and ask some questions about who could see what from where. Now, almost everything that I've showed you so far is based on bureaucratic records and plans created by the Nazis or their allies or their collaborators. The documentary archives are rich for mapping Nazi actions, camps and ghettos, and Nazi spatial visions of the Reich. But as audience after audience has asked members of our team, where are the people? Where are the victims? How do you bring them into the story? And this was the crucial point that we reached right about at the time we published our book in 2014. And we are trying to develop new strategies. This is where I now turn to sharing with you work that is just getting going and hoping for your help. Survivor testimony, I'll bring up the first little problem. Survivor testimony in a number of major Holocaust archives is incredibly rich with references to place, place names, descriptions of movement, descriptions of a home village, descriptions of a ghetto under siege, descriptions of camps. And it's a hugely understudied part of that documentary record. Our new research partner is the Shoah Foundation at USC, University of Southern California. They have 52,000 video interviews with Holocaust survivors. About 42,000 of them are in English, and so are accessible to all members of our team. They are beginning to transcribe them. They hope to transcribe them all someday. So our team is now trying to think, if they are transcribed, what can we learn from them? So we start with place names. I start with place names. But even just working with a sample of 10, this is from one man, Philip Reitman's testimony, an English speaker talking about growing up in Poland, in southern Poland, and then going through the Holocaust. Just these two place names, which are very important to his family. He says, Brisk. I'm doing a really good Philip Reitman imitation there, Brisk. And I'm trying to learn how to pronounce Polish so that I can figure out what Brisk would be in Polish. And is it that place? But when I look that place up on Falling Rain, which is a world gazetteer that is handy for the Holocaust because it's pretty good for Eastern Europe, there are a couple of places with that name. And was it this one or this one or this one? Brzani. Which one is it? And how can my untrained ears figure it out? Well, I could ask a Polish speaker, preferably an older Polish speaker, maybe who then lived in Canada, as Philip Reitman did, to do the transcription, but you see how immediately the problems begin to multiply. Holocaust survivor videos and transcripts are not nearly as tidy or as quickly analyzable, if I can say that, as the corpora that have been subjected to corpus linguistics and natural language processing so far, and geo-parsing. We are working with a wonderful colleague, Ian Gregory, at Lancaster University to try to figure out how to use a geo-parsing program with testimony. Maybe it could identify, well, 50% of our place names, but what about the other 50% if we want to work at a scale of 100 or 1,000 or 50,000? Different kind of example. I find some of the most spatially expressive language in the testimonies to be nothing to do with place names at all. It's passages like this. Here, a woman from Czechoslovakia, Anna Patipa, is talking about the first time her father is taken away from their village for forced labor. They sent him away somewhere before they took us. He wasn't there about a week, and I think it was Friday and Saturday were the last 2 days of Passover. And he came home Friday night, so Passover is a very helpful temporal clue, but we don't know what week it is. We don't even know what month it is. And the problem of geographical and temporal knowledge and specificity becomes greater and greater and greater as a survivor's narrative progresses through the stages of the Holocaust. People became so disoriented as they were taken away from their homes, as they were becoming emaciated, weakened, desperate. What do you notice? This is what Primo Levi gives us especially. I became my stomach. You focus on your survival and other things. You might notice the snow. You remember you lost your shoes just before it snowed, so you know it's in the winter. So you see our problem. The GIS approach requires specificity. I love it that GIS people refer to fuzzy information. This is beyond fuzzy, folks. Fuzzy, at least I can say that with a big smile on my face because I love my GIS friends and I'm a GIS user myself.
You call us blurry.
Yeah.
There's something in the middle of the fuzz.
There's something so important in the middle of the fuzz. If I can bring time in more explicitly here as well. The narrative of testimony has a very complex temporal structure. There is the time of the telling, which you can break down into minutes. And that, in fact, is what the Shoah Foundation has done. They've broken testimony into minute segments and indexed it, which is incredibly helpful for searching. But the stories themselves move back and forth in time. So someone is telling a story and then they remember, oh, but back in 38, and then they're back up to 1941 again. How do you handle that automatically? Very difficult to reconstruct time sequences for some people. Here's an example of one of those, gosh, place matters so much moments. In the testimony, and I apologize to those who saw my April presentation where I think I showed this as well. From Paul Schneidemann, another Polish Jewish survivor, time when he was at a labor site and the local commander took me into his office, and he had an office with whips hanging. He picked up which whip he would like to whip me with, and he says, etc. He put me down on a table there, and he strapped me down in front, and he gave me 25. The places in Holocaust testimony, this is a theory based on those I've read and listened to so far, the places in Holocaust testimony that matter the most are little places, a room, an unnamed field, something that is viscerally important to the telling of a story of survival or loss or death. And you can see when people are telling one of these stories, they often slow down, their eyes either go inward or have a sort of intense focus. How do we find those moments automatically if we're using corpus linguistics methods? I'm beginning to think that there are certain verbal clues like then he or one day I, that we can also search for the stories that really matter the most, which maybe it makes no sense at all to map with GIS, but it might make sense to know this comes at the point where Schneidemann is in a labor camp somewhere, and in the labor camp, his stories become most meaningful. So maybe it becomes a sort of conceptual graphic, if that makes sense. But I also dream of being able to bring hundreds and thousands of survivors' stories onto a screen, which also shows the opening and closing of Nazi camps and ghettos, so that we can see the larger context in which every one of these stories is taking place. And I'd love for your thoughts. That is where we stand right now. Any and all of this, I've had wonderful conversations already today with Wendy and Ben, who have given me many rich ideas, technical and otherwise, for how to approach this, but I'm really eager for your thoughts.
Have people thought about analyzing the visual part of your videos?
Yes.
Or gestures and expressions?
Yes, and that, Josh, raises another issue, that the transcriptions do not capture that very rich human communication. I mentioned the Philip Reitman. He was the one with Brisk. He's a very emotional man. And I started annotating the transcript of his with gestures and when he cries. If we could do that, which the Shoah Foundation is considering doing, then we could search on those sorts of moments as a way to find stories.
Yeah.
And to see a change in scale, and yeah.
Yeah, that's not terribly difficult with the computer vision algorithms.
Can you give me an example?
My son did a little project, you know, an open source library, which basically would watch you through your webcam and tell when you were closing your eyes.
As an automatic detection. So when someone turned their head, it could be automatically detected from a video?
Yeah. So you'd have to distinguish, you know, telltales that you're interested in, but those individual telltale movements or appearances in like blink rate or something like that are pretty straightforward to do.
What about pauses? Because that's also associated with when a traumatic story is coming or someone is in the midst and having difficulty, that a pause goes beyond a certain number of seconds.
That's audio.
Yeah, that's audio.
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't be the analysis of the visual appearance, unless there was something that people were doing in those pauses. You know, if somebody's putting their head down, and that's what you're looking for.
Right.
You're identifying, you know, is it a pause to take a breath, or is it a pause because it's an emotional transition?
Right.
But that combination, when you have some hooks for the visual and you can do things in audio, and then you're basically looking at combinations, it gives you an even richer bunch of things.
Maybe I should go to my last page and mention what we do plan to do right now. I mentioned the GeoParser. We think that corpus linguistics and natural language processing methods can help us find the difficult places that need to be researched, the really uncertain names, so that we could reserve our labor-intensive inquiry for what at Lancaster they call the sin bin. The names that are kicked out of the software that they've developed as unrecognizable. I kind of like that, sin bin. I've also talked, especially with Ben and Lex, about our either building a gazetteer of the Holocaust or finding existing gazetteers that can help us verify the locations of the databases we've already built, like the camps and ghettos, and help us solve the problems in testimonial mentions of places.
What sort of metadata is given with these videos?
There is, depending on the source, depending on who conducted the interviews, it varies. At the Shoah Foundation, it also varies with at what stage in a project. But at the Shoah Foundation, the typical metadata is a biography of the person in written text and a list of questions that the questioner was given to be sure to cover. The Shoah Foundation interviews are the most structured, which is both helpful for a project like ours and problematic because they shape the responses into the before, during, and after sequence of a film. Steven Spielberg created the Shoah Foundation, and he wanted the videos to be used initially to make films about the Holocaust. So there was a reason for that shaping. Other testimonies, I don't know what metadata, for example, Yale has in the Fortune of Art Archive, where the testimony is much more free form and much longer, instead of 2 or 2.5 hours, 5-6 hours long, and probably much, much fuller of useful information, potential data, but also much less structured and probably harder to put in ordered sequence. But places are not documented.
Right. I mean,
there's no metadata on places, as far as I know.
And I mean, how often do the subjects mention the camp they were at, or ghetto they were at, or their?
If they know the name, it seems as if they know the name, they give it.
But it's verbal.
It's verbal, and it's hard to parse.
Yeah.
And it also depends how long they were there. Paul Schneiderman was at this work camp for months. And elsewhere in the testimony, he names it. So we can be fairly confident about that. But there are so many, I forgot, I mentioned this to Wendy. There's so many different kinds of movements in these people's stories that are significant. A movement of a kilometer to a killing site that they happen to have escaped from. A movement of 1,000 kilometers to Ravensbrück from Czechoslovakia. And with all of them with different qualities of uncertainty, mappability, and so forth. The real problem here is not mapping a survivor or a small number of survivors. We could cherry pick mappable stories, and some people have, like Martin Gilbert, in fact, has done that in a few of his atlases. But we'd like to do it at scale. Yes?
So maybe this is an obvious question, but based on my knowledge of Poland, like if you're coming from a particular town, you know, there's like, I'd say, 80% certainty that you and the group of Jews coming from your town would be moved from one ghetto to a particular other ghetto, and then you'd be moved to a camp. So certainly it didn't happen to everyone, and your survivors would be atypical.
Yes. Yes.
Right? But,
yes.
But that data, if you're trying to kind of generally understand how this movement happened, that
yes.
would be available almost like not just by testimony, but from, you know, data on those locations where Jews live.
Well, and that's a very, very good observation, and that's a set of, that's a kind of information that we are also hoping to extract from the Holocaust Museum's two-book volume on the ghettos in German-occupied Eastern Europe. We're building a database of ghettos that I would very much like to include the information about the Łódź, a third of the people in the Łódź ghetto were sent to Auschwitz or sent to Berlin or whatever at a certain date. Much of that information, everything their researchers know about that kind of movement is in that encyclopedia. So that would give broad brush information that is crucial. And then that could help us sort out the testimonies. Maybe I should just calm down and say, this is 10 years. Give it 10 years and we'll figure it all out, including that kind of work. I'm just so eager to see it done. Lex?
From what you talked about today, there seems to be a tension between the need to try to build something that can be partly automated at scale.
Yeah.
In which case that requires something like some kind of structural element, some kind of structural schematization of experience.
Yes.
And the experience.
Absolutely.
Which you want to honor by doing this.
So we need to work at several scales.
Yeah, but I was thinking, like, so how do you approach that technically?
Mm.
That's quite a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that popped into my mind were that, well, specific places is kind of like a gazetteer function.
Mm-hmm.
Can you identify a string as a possible place name, and then can you identify where it is? But these others you had are also interesting because you pointed out their importance, and I was wondering more about clues that you could possibly set up in your algorithm or NLP or whatever technique you're using in the texts that would look for things like, you know, a set of terms like office, room,
yes,
hero,
yep,
and into, you know, or out of,
mm-hmm,
and then that could be set up to point to say, well, kick that into the bin of a possible local place,
right,
or field, or somewhere, or out of,
mm-hmm,
away from, as like into these general places. I don't know, just an idea. Like, I guess this is a question back to you.
Yeah.
It's like, what is your plan to honor these like very complex experiences that are negative and not classifiable,
mm-hmm,
into bins that you can then use to honor style from these texts?
Well, we see a lot of potential in using collocation and some other corpus methods for finding expressions of experience that we would then write about in text. We are thinking of a book about keywords in testimony and what they reveal about spatial experience and movement. And there might be some diagrams in there, but possibly very, very few maps. But I also really want to provide a map that Holocaust studies doesn't have. And I'm also interested conceptually in the issues that text raises, because I'm told by people in oral history that discipline is at a kind of tipping point where more and more oral historians want to work digitally and they want to work at scale, but they're confronting all of these complexities of native expression and how people talk about place in a very unspecific but meaningful way. So if we can solve some or even just raise some of these issues and get more people working on them, we may begin to find some joint solutions for oral history. Of many kinds.
This is kind of the premise of the digging into data,
mm-hmm,
program,
mm-hmm,
is to try to handle, you know, the ability to digitize has gotten way ahead of the ability to interpret.
Yes,
and,
precisely.
So it's trying to balance those.
Precisely.
But Lex and I have sort of, in talking about gazetteers, have run into the same thing where,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's at one time an expression of all that we know about place for a time region, but also an index into all the information that has been located there.
Yeah.
And those are not one-way relationships, because the ability to index indicates that you've detected or interpreted consistency in the evidence that you're trying to index with it. So it's like, you know, indexing something where you don't know what the alphabet is yet.
Yeah, that fits.
And you have to figure out what the alphabet is so that you can index things.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah. So, or if not alphabet, at least, to be a little cruder, keywords. What are spatial keywords?
Yeah.
Spatial prepositions are suddenly enormously interesting to me. With and without begins immediately to sort out testimony into the kinds of experience that someone is having as a first cut. Yes.
This is such a complex project. Really, there's no one answer. There's no one method that will get you everywhere you
no,
want to go.
No.
But when you were describing the kind of arc from of these testimonies, from here's where I am, I know where I am in my home village, moving toward ambiguity and uncertainty and fuzziness. I mean, from an intellectual perspective, that kind of that is the most. I mean, the technical questions are
that
so
gotcha.
Interesting too, that got me. And I've just been sitting here thinking, so is she describing a process? I mean, essentially what your project seems to be doing is kind of inverting our expectations of specificity or accuracy and meaning. We expect meaning to come with specificity and accuracy. Whereas in this project, it's very clear, at least it seems clear from the last, you know, half hour, that it's almost, it's that's inverted.
Yes.
That the more you, the more specificity falls away,
yeah,
the more, you know, accuracy and our ability to document falls away, the more you get to how experience is defined, you know, from the individual perspective anyway, right? So I've been trying to decide whether you're telling a story about kind of the, a story of disintegration of spatial structures, and a story at the same time, distillation of spatial structures, right? You're moving, all that we know falls away, it disintegrates, right, in the fabric of these stories. And what you're left with is something that gets, so from a spatial perspective, from a GIS perspective, it's all fallen to pieces, right? But from the perspective of trying to construct experience from an individual level, and maybe from that very highly historicized level, you've got a distillation, right? Of, you know, all of those other bits of my life have now fallen away, and now here's what happened to me when all of a sudden my backside is being, you know, torn to pieces, the skin is being shredded from my back, and all I know is that I'm on top of a table. Incredibly unspecific, but highly specific place.
Yeah.
So to me, it's the story that you described of disintegration and distillation. And I don't know if those would be useful terms.
That's
here
very mind, exciting, very helpful. You didn't, did you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm in the history department here, Kelly O'Neill. Maybe recognize
you're me. Kelly.
Yeah.
I saw you present in April, but we didn't have a time to chat
so,
much.
Yeah.
Right.
That's my
It's falling away for the places are, and families and social networks are all falling away, disintegrating, fraying, etc. At the same time, though, for convenience, what I call the Nazi universe is becoming more and more definite.
Right.
So showing those two together, figuring out the visualization strategy, Mr. Cartographer, is another challenge in my mind. I have all sorts of visions of how to do this, but they involve animation and flying in and out of scale and darkening and things going. You talk about fuzzy, the building goes like this, and then suddenly there's the guard.
The other thing I was wondering too is, would it be helpful to think about, you know, you're showing the map of Auschwitz in its idealized form, and then the different kinds of buildings that existed that weren't supposed to exist, but
right.
Are there moments where you see the kind of Nazi spatial plan having to compromise?
Yes. Yes, right? That's an example of that.
Right, right. Yep. So you have the barracks that are being constructed. And mm-hmm. again, developing a series of forms of compromise and how those mm-hmm. are expressed, mm-hmm. you know, architecturally, and whether those architectural mm-hmm. compromises then translate back into the ideology, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that's awfully interesting.
Too. Yep, and even the movement, the dreadful events from summer of 41 to summer and fall of 42, as the mass killings in fields and ditches and forests are going on, and it's becoming less and less tenable. And the compromise is, we have to stop doing this, but we've also killed a lot of the people we wanted to, so a movement to a whole different strategy mm-hmm. is another form of compromise. Mm-hmm. That's... Glad to know you, Kelly. Yes?
So this is just, you know, kind of a random question, but I wonder how does this relate to literature that's trying to make Holocaust imaginable and all the protests against that literature, right? Because there's been all these arguments whether we can make this imaginable.
Yep.
And it seems like we're trying to make it more, you know, personal.
Are you thinking of Sol Friedlander?
Yeah, I mean, I just attended this Holocaust Museum workshop in summer, and I remember the big debate between historians and sociologists, and some people really up in arms against making it imaginable because that's
yes.
not what it should be. And I don't have a position on that, but it sounds like you're trying to make it more.
Well, it's yeah. something that our group is, we're sort of on high alert about how freighted visualization is for people. I just want to mention before I forget, there's a sort of companion volume 20, 25 years later to Sol Friedlander's book, just come out last week with Harvard University Press on the ethics of Holocaust culture, edited by Claudio Fogu and others, F-O-G-U, that might interest you on this. Gosh, everything from the colors that one uses in a map can be inflammatory to 3D visualization. When we showed this at the Holocaust Museum in a presentation, there were some folks in the audience who said, you're not gonna do fly-throughs, are you? And we said, no, we have no interest in doing fly-throughs. What I see, Lex gave us the word tension. I think there's a really important moral and ethical tension when one works visually that is more acute than when you are writing, where we know how to handle words in ways that don't offend or that acknowledge that we're going into delicate territory. I don't think we're as good at signaling that visually.
But it seems like you talked in the spring, and there was a couple of much more concrete sort of problems with visualization. One of them is not just showing something, but showing something as someone in the neighborhood
yes.
would have been able to see it.
That's right.
Have been able to see it.
Yeah, the
or
perspective.
You were talking about the, you know, the routes of evacuation and mm-hmm. having a map that shows that it went through the center of this town.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, the provocation is that it's much more difficult for someone to say, well, I lived there, but I didn't know yeah. anything. What's going on. So
yeah.
Maybe it's not so much the visual language, it's the existence of the spatial relationships that it uncovers.
Where the visual language becomes crucial, I think, though, is at the point of publication. Mm-hmm. When you are going to be addressing your audience, you have to be prepared. You have to have reasons mm-hmm. for designing and representing. So working back from that, mm-hmm. it's become a constant question in our project. And GIS is problematic there. GIS maps, especially to those who don't make them and aren't inured to them, look technical, modern, I mean present day, and so forth. They're problematic too. How do you humanize GIS representation? How do you historicize it? We need more historians working in GIS. That's part of the answer, I think.
General questions, kind of thinking out loud. The difficulty of pinning down the location in these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's because of the scale of the events?
That's part of it.
Because the date being like 60-70 years ago, or something else, or a combination of it, because I'm comparing this with, say, my own and my family's experience during the Chinese Cultural Revolution.
Yes.
Very similar, you know, encampments and relocation, you know, different experience and so on. But that's only 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a whole lot of difficulty to identify the exact location. Every small event that family could remember, that it's always there. But
were you moved around, or were you in one? Oh, you were.
Quite a bit.
Within a territory that you knew?
Well, some places was new. Some places were like related to my family's origin. But in any case, there's, you know, I still remember traveling. I was 5 years old. Still remember traveling by train, by boat, by donkey, by bike, and walk.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
And just from that vague memory, it's not that hard to really draw the route in modern day map based on the place name. And the place names changed a whole lot too during the different political eras that the place names changed. But because it's only 50 years, I guess it's not hard to trace back what it was called before. Sometimes it was called something else and then called back to the older name again.
Right.
But then we don't have language issue. The language is the same. It's within the same.
That's
country.
Fairly large.
So there weren't people using different names and different languages for it? And that's a big Eastern Europe.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's probably. You know,
there's a different name in every language.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might use the local name. You might use the name that it had when it was part of another country. You might use the name that somebody who's a different country that you're traveling with uses for.
But even if you're using different names, wouldn't that knowledge already there that these names are the same place? That's, you know, not the interviewer would know, or the person, you know, being interviewed would know.
Should be able to figure that out.
From the jazz is here perspective, though, experience tells us that there are nationalist efforts over and over to eradicate the local names of the past. So, you know, we do have problems actually knowing what original names were. And then further, I just wanted to point out that if we have the person,
yes,
like your case, you can say, I remember what it was, I can go find it.
Yeah.
That's totally different from just having a transcript of some word someone said.
Yes.
Right. And trying to figure out what did they mean? Because you could have said breast, which is on the border of Belarus.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know what he said.
Yeah.
So, and then exactly what Joshua said, which is that, you know, people speak from different dialects or languages, they actually
They may be mispronouncing a name that somebody told them in a different language.
That's frequent for survivors who end up in different countries and often in Germany by the end. And something else is the structure of the interviews and what the interviewers and the sponsoring organization are trying to get out of people. They want stories. They're not asking for, may I get in touch with you later, Kelly? Oh, okay. So they don't ask, where is that, ever. That's not their goal. And I don't think I'll ever be able to meet any of the people who were interviewed. In the 90s, the Shoah Foundation did 95% of its interviews between about 1994 and 1998. So it was a huge push all at once that Spielberg wanted to get as many people while they were alive and well and before their memories went and they died.
So here's the thing. Probably most people here are familiar with cold weather and the sort of ability to crowdsource something, like gamification or something, giving people a way to identify with the topic that they are transcribing.
Yes.
As a way of getting more eyeballs on a subject. Now, you know, this is
more sensitive. I'm thinking about crowdsourcing.
Situation, but the family members, interviewers, may be invited to comment or contribute a little bit of the story, like, okay, this is where they were from. I don't know all this place you talked about, but they were from here, so therefore it must have been a point of origin. You could try to track it from there.
Right.
Or people might get more interested and say, oh, I think it's something about that place. And if you can isolate those points in the text first, maybe using NLP tagging process.
Right.
And then turn it into a task and say, you know, would you go through just the placing and help us try to learn more about them? If you could create something as simple as geo-inspector, like the New York Public Library did, where the tasks that the person are asked to do are so limited that one or two clicks, and the amount of thinking that goes into it is limited, they got a much higher rate of response. I mean, this is something that NYPL learned after having tried all these different kinds of crowdsourcing.
Right.
They gave them all the bells and whistles and could steer everything, and they got very few results. They said, just answer this one question. And people were so willing to do that one step that they got a huge amount of results.
Well, that's neat.
But again, you know, the degree in which people can deal with this material if it is their family member is a whole different issue. So you probably have to handle it very carefully.
Yeah.
I fully agree with you. I think to me that would be a crowdsourcing. That would be a high potential for crowdsourcing. To help with this, and maybe not even restricted to family members.
Yeah.
But as long as you can filter it to maybe a particular context and space, maybe in time as well. So Southwest Poland.
Yes.
The time.
Yeah.
People from that area might be able to help then. So that I think that would be promising. I fully agree with this. In terms of the cartography and the visualization.
Yes.
I think it's quite complex because what you want to do is on different scales,
correct? Yes, right.
As well as in the space-time continuum.
Yes.
So you have three, basically, elements.
All these dimensions,
But I definitely agree with what have been said before. I think that interactivity and animation might be a key attribute for doing that. It's a little bit off the track, but you might have seen those maps which show how many Americans are currently in planes over the US or so. Have you seen that?
No, not that.
Those
one.
Are animated maps where there are planes flying over the US.
Oh, yeah. I've seen the takeoffs.
So something like this I permanently had in mind when I thought about that. During time, so that when time goes, you see all those displacements and things moving and how the plan is manifesting, so to say.
This is how I would like to map what you were suggesting.
Yes. But then when you click on one of those, You zoom into the individual story, so to say.
Yes.
That will be what you have in mind, correct?
That is very much what I have in mind, yeah. Or that out of the of movement, almost like plucking a string, that you could find someone who's in that movement.
There must be a model which links both.
Is
part of that.
Yes, sir.
Something that Slate just won an award for visualization of the African slave trade.
Slate did.
Yeah.
Oh.
And this is sort of what it looks like from the bottom.
Oh yes, that's wonderful, isn't it?
So they have.
Although people as dots disturbs some.
Yes. Well, these are
but
ships.
The ships. Yeah.
And so it's lots and lots of people, and it disturb. And then you can pause it and see the ship manifests. Have.
Right.
So I don't know like what kinds of data might be available, like train manifests or something like that. That is
Train. When we started in 2008 with our first grant, we thought let's build the train network and map the transports, and it turned out to be a nightmare, partly because we could only find one scholar, a geographer, who had really studied the German trains. The train system during World War II, So there would have been a whole lot of groundwork to do. And even though many of the tracks are where they are today, where they were then, figuring out when trains are actually moving and how many people they have would be, that's probably a 3 to 5 year project, which I wasn't sufficiently interested in. But the other thing is, with all of these ideas and many, many more, the Holocaust Geographies Project should have 5 or 6 major players who are working on different parts of it to build out the many stories, the many scales, and so forth. So, yes.
Oh, you.
So you started out talking about what information is missing from a lot of these maps and how these geographic things are frustrating to you. And
yeah.
You talked a bit about these spatial ideas. And when I hear about the testimonies, it seems to me like this is a story of dots that are not really, the testimonies don't seem like they're trying to connect those dots. The testimonies don't seem like,
no.
It seems like it's a story of deep, displacement, losing a sense of space and losing your sense of space. And if that's what if that's what was part of this political effort was to de-ground people,
yes,
right? To disconnect you from space.
You betcha.
Why isn't that the story? As opposed to trying to create a map of where they're going.
My thoughts were kind of along the same lines. Why not, abandon the geo part of it, as much as it hurts me to say that as a geography GIS guy. But just in the few quotes you've shown us, you have tables, rooms, barracks.
Yeah.
And just by using those sorts of words that evoke certain emotions during the videos, imagine a dot per person, and there's maybe a dozen major places mentioned. Now they don't have a specific coordinate, but it's a table or it's a chair. And as they mention these, then the dots kind of reshuffle themselves and you see this density, and maybe you color them based on emotions, felt at the time, and you do a visualization that's not geographic, but it's very place-oriented.
The density focused of mention of meaningful places could have voice, so that it's human.
Exactly. And then it's something other than text, other than words.
Yeah.
As humans understand visual, visualizations, color, and shape, and movement a whole lot better than words sometimes.
Yeah.
Why not try and take these 52,000 videos and keywords, it's similar to the word cloud, except make it more interesting with instead of having, just a bunch of words, make these things they mentioned as places in space, and then show
those,
the
social network. You're distinguishing sorry to be technical, the feature in the geometry. You can extract all of these mentions and interactions with features apart from being able to absolutely locate them. But that's part of the story that this is a resistance to.
Yes.
Big part of the story was isolation, as you said, degrounding.
Yeah.
Creating these
degrounding, aiding destruction.
But isolating it, so people were able to say it was somewhere else. And so it seems like, it's the hardest part,
give place
saying
somewhere
this
else.
Happened in the world, it happened in your world is a very important goal.
Well, something I've been thinking ever since we had that sort of moment on the road to Damascus when we realized that the humans were missing from our maps, that GIS may be excellent for portraying Nazi places and spaces, but that other visual methods and voice, I'm just so determined to get the human voice into representation here. Not through words, I mean people saying things.
Well, there's an interesting tension there, because aren't maps largely a political project, right?
I think the world is a political project, and we all have political projects, and maps have been critiqued brilliantly as political projects, and they've been the Brian Harley and Ann Godlewska and others out of the history of cartography say maps are the handmaiden of empire and oppression and brutality in world history. And I absolutely believe that. But I think there are also ways to make, I'm sorry to jump down your throat. This is something I teach a whole course about. And how do you make your own politics clear if you're making a map of any kind? Or using a map, it's crucial.
Yeah, and just like how do you insert the politics that are relevant? Like, how do you kind of like, you know, like if people don't know where they are, should they? Like, how do you like, you know, that's like a like if maps are a way in which like space is controlled from off top.
Yes.
How do you stay honest to that?
So that's another interesting technical detail. Which
yes.
One of the ways that maps do that is because they deal in objects, what we call vectors, right? And so there's always the choice, you know, the vector means there's something that's recognized as there, and where there isn't a vector, there's no recognition. Or there's denial that there's anything there.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it may be useful to have a spatial, you know, a time slider in a map that shows objects moving around.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, it can be even more powerful to have representations. You say, okay, there were people everywhere.
Yes.
This is the variation in some qualities of them mm-hmm. over time and place. But
I think
that addresses it, not completely, but addresses a little bit the bias that goes into creating a map.
What you've just said, Josh, I think helps explain the current popularity of heat maps.
Yeah.
That they look approximate, they visualize our sense of things as not being sharply defined and graded.
That has a probability surface.
Yes, but many people looking at heat maps and using heat maps and making heat maps aren't thinking about the mathematics.
No, but a heat map could actually have good stats behind it.
Yes, it could, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But all I meant is that they have a humanistic quality that appeals to people.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that it's absolutely true that if you're just looking for a visualization form to display what you capture in the interviews, then maybe abandoning space would be mm-hmm. one approach, a powerful approach.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're thinking of understanding those stories, I'm a diehard geographer, so I wouldn't say abandoned space, because you may not use it to let other people visualize a personal experience. That may not be always helpful,
mm-hmm.
but it's certainly helpful for the historian, the scholar, to understand these stories.
Yes.
I'm thinking of anything, sure, but you know, triangulation in a way
mm-hmm.
that when you have your database have many, many interviews, right? And some of them probably have been co-located and
yes.
in places, and they describe things in
yes.
the same way, and then sometimes in a different way.
Yes.
There are other cues that prompt you to understand that they're talking about the same thing,
mm-hmm.
but then you realize that they're using different terms. So
mm-hmm.
if you have multiple cases, you may be able to triangulate into
yes.
a more precise location
yes.
in some way. There's no, I can't offer any specific methodology, but just thinking out loud.
I think there are other kinds of knowledge as well, historical and geographical knowledge that we could gain if we can work with testimonies at a very large scale.
Mm-hmm.
There's such a gap in the historiography between what historians have been able to study from the Nazi documents and the way they have studied victims, which is almost always at a very individual level or at most a village. We're looking, or another way to explain what I would like to do is develop a mesoscale, an intermediate scale of analysis that would need to be partly mm-hmm. geometrical, but also carry in more of the richness and particular knowledge of people.
And by knowing even proximity of the location,
yes.
I would say that you could enrich
that personal experience or into our understanding of their experience by bringing in, you mentioned about the weather, how foreign that culture is from their home. You know, the natural condition, the all that that may not be mentioned in the deep interview, but then it's experienced by the person anyway. So, you know, by abandoning location, you would lose all that connection.
That's
all
right.
All those correlations.
Well, you don't need to worry about that. I'm a geographer too, so that I always do come back to that. But distinguishing features from geometry is a very helpful idea. And I really am drawn to the idea of setting aside maps entirely for a while and thinking about people in other possible ways. Yeah, you guys are incredibly helpful.
So with that, we're pretty much
out of time. Yeah,
I want to thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. I always forget to put my email at the end, but I'm just ann.knowles@maine.edu. So if you have other ideas or suggestions, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you so much. I always love coming down here. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Let me jump on there.
Yes.
Recording.
Oh, I forgot all about the recording.
How it's supposed to be.
Oh, thank you for your suggestions. Yeah, I think animation is going to be enormously helpful in the storytelling and in connecting.